It's become one of the cliches of our culture, a hypnotist dangling a pocket watch before someone's eyes while softly chanting, "You're feeling sleepy, very sleepy." But although it's been a part of many a magician's act, hypnosis is far from a magic trick, even though how it works isn't all that well understood. On today's edition of Please Explain, we'll try to figure out how hypnosis works and look into how it can be effective in treating people who want to stop smoking, lose weight, or manage pain. We're joined now by Dr. Roberta Temes, a hypnotist, psychologist, and author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Hypnosis, and Dr. Amir Raz, professor in the departments of psychiatry, neurology, and neurosurgery, and psychology, and research chair in the cognitive neuroscience of attention at McGill University and SMBD Jewish General Hospital. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amir, weren't you once a magician?
Yes, I was.
Was that after you got your degree in medicine?
No, that was before, way before, and I'm actually speaking more of as a brain scientist, but I can definitely tell you that my magic adventure has definitely informed my knowledge of hypnosis.
So, Roberta, let's get to basics. What is hypnosis? Is it an altered state of consciousness?
Well, it is, and it is a state of very deep concentration. I can tell you what it's not. It is not sleep. Because in sleep, you're not aware of what's going on, whereas in hypnosis, you're extremely focused. It's not meditation, because in meditation, you think of nothing, whereas in hypnosis, you're thinking of a particular something that you want to accomplish.
Is it a trance?
We can call it a trance. It's an altered state of consciousness where you are deeply, deeply suggestible.
Are there different kinds of hypnosis and different kinds of hypnotic states?
Well, there are different ways to practice hypnosis. There are the entertainment hypnotists whose goal is to inform an audience about all the wonders and delightful tricks that can be done. And then there are the clinical hypnotists who want to help someone change their behavior.
Amir, if you were to hypnotize me, how would you begin? We often think of that dangling pocket watch or staring into a spiral, but is a visual like that actually needed?
It actually isn't. You can do quite well without it. As a matter of fact, induction practices are very diverse, and they're usually tailored to the individual. It is possible to induce people into hypnosis or hypnotic-like experience very quickly or very slowly, very gradually or very abruptly. And many people go into hypnotic planes very, very naturally without anybody telling them what to do. It's possible to be hypnotized while you jog, while you walk, while you meditate, while you pray, while you shop, and while you're taking the subway.
Must I be a willing participant? Can I fight being hypnotized?
You can definitely fight being hypnotized. One of the going theories is that people who are naturally, biologically, highly hypnotizable will not be able to, because it's almost like something that is your fingerprint. You cannot find you cannot fight your fingerprint too much. But it's definitely possible for some individuals who are not interested, or most individuals, let's say, to, if they don't want to be hypnotized, they can just distract themselves or think not comply with what you tell them to think about or follow, and that they would just basically steer clear of the process.
Well, if you don't tell somebody that you're trying to hypnotize them, is it possible to do it without their knowledge?
It's probably possible to do it without their knowledge to a certain extent, but even then, it's going to be a different kind of hypnosis than what we see on the Woody Allen movies.
Uh-huh. Well, Roberta, what kinds of things is hypnosis used for? We mentioned stopping smoking. I think a lot of people try that.
Sure, and your listeners should know that you really just need one session to stop smoking, maybe two.
And that lasts a lifetime?
Sure. What I do in my practice is I encourage people to come with a recording device, and that way they have a recording of it. If they ever need reinforcement, they just play their recording.
And that's all they need?
That's right.
Don't need you there?
No, they just need it. Oh, hypnosis works great. Hypnosisbyphone.com. Hypnosis works great with CDs, with tapes, on the phone.
Is it different if you're hypnotizing somebody to stop smoking from when you're trying to hypnotize them before they go into surgery?
Well, it's a matter of saying different things. The induction is the same, and then once they're in the suggestible state, I will say something to them appropriate for what they came for. If they come for pre-surgical anxiety, we'll talk about them having no pain afterward and things like that.
So you're really inducing a calm state. And cigarette smoking often is connected with anxiety as well. I know whenever I got nervous when I was a smoker, I reached for a cigarette.
Right, but some people actually smoke to get hyped up, to get more energy. So that's not necessarily the case.
Amir, what got you interested in hypnosis? Because you were thinking of becoming a magician?
Well, I think that, you know, becoming a magician was not necessarily, I mean, I didn't have hypnosis in mind when I became a magician. It was sort of, you know, serendipity and a bit of randomness in my life when I was younger. But definitely through the magic lens, I was able to see many things that would be difficult for an academic to see or for a social psychologist. Performers, people who are basically masters of the stage, are manipulating their audiences. They're giving a good show. They need to keep, you know, their audiences attention. They need to be eloquent. They need to have good showmanship skills in general. And hypnosis, in many ways, requires, especially when you have a group of people that you're trying to work with, requires all these skills. So magicians are great because they're basically the clinicians of attention. They do it for entertainment purposes, and many times they don't know what is working and why. But they do know how to do things. Sometimes in sort of a mechanical, you know, way. But it works very well. And sometimes you have very nice illusions, very entertaining and so on, and these are completely scientifically based.
But in your academic life, don't you study focused attention and the susceptibility to suggestion?
Absolutely.
Are they the same thing as hypnotism?
Right. So I was groomed as an attention researcher, and fortunately, in psychology, we have more than 100 years of very, you know, elaborate research into mechanisms of attention and what people pay attention to, what they don't pay attention to, and that sort of created a situation where I could study hypnosis with the tools of academia and with very controlled experiments and do all kinds of fancy things like, you know, neuroimaging and see what's happening in the brains of people when they get hypnotized and so on. And these kind of approaches teach us quite a bit about what's going on at the brain level when people are doing these things, and it looks, at least from you know, a very cursory foray into these things, that what is really happening is that people are paying attention in very different ways to all kinds of sensations and experiences and perceptions that they don't usually pay attention to in the same way in their common wakefulness.
Don't studies show that hypnosis affects the amygdala?
It could. I mean, it depends exactly, you know, what suggestion is being made and to whom. But it's definitely possible to change or to regulate amygdala activity with suggestions.
So, are you saying that the brain functions pretty much the same way as it does when it's not under hypnosis, or do we see different kinds of firings when we look at an MRI of somebody who is being hypnotized?
So that's a very tricky question, because there are many sort of caveats to everything one would say, and you know, as a responsible scientist, I have to like choose my words very carefully. But we can definitely show certain things very clearly. For example, we can demonstrate that individuals or particularly highly hypnotizable individuals can sometimes perform certain tasks that is very difficult or almost impossible for them to perform without hypnosis, and that they recruit certain brain areas to do these things, and we can actually see these brain areas in the scanner. And these areas usually include areas that we know are involved in attention networks. So it's quite clear that people who are highly hypnotizable, especially when they're challenged with a particular task, are able sometimes to perform a task that would be very difficult for them to do otherwise with a particular hypnotic suggestion. And as a result, they're sort of using their brain slightly differently. But as of today, we haven't been able to demonstrate clearly in sort of a clear-cut way that there is a brain state or a brain signature where you can look at someone's brain and say, this person is hypnotized. So we're not there yet, but we do have some leads to sort of suggest that there's something funky happening when people are hypnotized.
Roberta, as a practicing hypnotist, do you even concern yourself with the neuroscience of the whole thing?
Well, I'm aware of it, but it has nothing to do with my day-to-day operation. When someone comes in to me because they're nervous about their big test tomorrow, I simply hypnotize them to relax and give them the suggestion that whatever they know is going to just come right from their brain to their paper or to the computer screen easily, and they'll be able to do great on the test.
How long have you been doing this?
Oh, very long.
How did you get involved?
I got involved because I saw it work very, very well once. And I thought, well, if it works so well, I ought to find out about how it works. And I started to study it and learned that I was really good at it. When, you know, there is no formal way to learn hypnosis. There's no state requirement or license. You could hang out a shingle and say you're a hypnotist on the basis of having spoken to us for an hour.
Isn't that a bit scary?
Yeah. That's why you have to be very careful who you go to.
And yeah, but there's a little, I mean, it's true that, you know, that being a hypnotist is unregulated, but there are certain ways, you know, that one can go about this and get not necessarily, you know, certified by a regulatory organization, but definitely by certain organizations that are slightly more, you know, reputable than others. In the United States, I would say that the two major hypnosis societies are the Society for Clinical and Experimental Hypnosis and the American Society of Clinical Hypnosis. They both hold memberships, you know, with the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the World Federation for Mental Health. And these are really, you know, kosher, real organizations.
That's true, except that if you look at your average hypnotist who's in the yellow pages or with a shingle out the door, they haven't studied with them. They went to Joe Schmo down the street who said, let me teach you in a weekend class how to do this.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a little break and talk more about this, find out whether there are side effects, how the whole idea of hypnotism even was discovered. And, of course, we'll take a lot of listener calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Dr. Roberta Temes, a hypnotist, psychologist, and author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Hypnosis. And you're scaring me when you say idiot's guide, because if you don't have to get a license, that means a couple of idiots might be out there right now practicing it. Dr. Amir Raz, professor in the departments of psychiatry, neurology, and neurosurgery, and psychology, and Canada research chair in the cognitive neuroscience of attention at McGill University and SMBD Jewish General Hospital. I'm not going to say that every time I identify you, Dr. Raz, because that's a long, long title.
That's okay. I hardly say it myself.
We'll be back right after this. And we're talking about hypnotism on today's Please Explain with Dr. Roberta Temes and Dr. Amir Raz. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. We also are going to deal with some of your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. But just two things before we get to the calls. One, how was hypnotism even discovered in the first place? Does anybody know who the first person who practiced hypnotism was?
I think it's difficult to answer this question from like a historical perspective because of documentation and what do we mean by hypnosis and so on and so forth. But it's quite clear that, you know, hypnosis-like experiences were available or at least documented, you know, even going back to like Egyptian hieroglyphics. You know, I'm not talking about, you know, the Rosetta Stone in particular, but you can actually trace it back thousands of years. In European heritage, it's common to start with sort of, you know, Anton Mesmer, and then we have this word in English, you know, to mesmerize based on what happened back then. But that takes us back only about, you know, 250, 220 years. I would say that most people, when you talk to them about hypnosis, when they think back about it, they usually go back to Mesmer. But it's really possible if you're very academic about it to trace it back really far.
Now, go ahead.
I would guess that the first time that a mother put a baby in her arms and rocked the baby and sung a lullaby, she was hypnotizing that child to sleep.
Now, a lot of the callers and the people who have written in on a comment page are concerned about pain, pain-free births, pain-free operations. If I were about to go into an operation, how would you approach me, Roberta? What would you do?
Okay, first I would tell you, I would first find out what your problems are as far as the surgery. What are you nervous about? What are you anxious about? And then we would develop
Dying?
Okay, there you go. We would develop sentences. Each sentence would be something that would be a suggestion given you, that you would, in fact, recover easily and quickly, that it would be no big deal, that you would be grateful to have the opportunity to have whatever is dangerous removed from your body, that your vital signs would be stable, that you would need no pain medicine because you wouldn't feel pain afterward.
No, but you're just reassuring me. That's not hypnosis, is
it? Well, if I say it to you while you're in a hypnotic state.
Yeah, but how would you get me into that hypnotic state? I mean, are you going to be dangling that watch in front of me?
Well, I don't do it with stuff. I do it with my voice. As you can tell, I have a very boring voice. I kind of get people into this state right away. My voice would get you into the suggestible state. Often, I say the following. I have people imagine perhaps a flight of stairs, and they're walking up the stairs. They're counting. I'm counting from 1 to 5. As they walk up the stairs, they become more and more suggestible. When they reach the top step, they are deeply hypnotized.
We have a number of messages from listeners. One says, I've been hypnotized by a licensed psychotherapist twice for a compulsive behavior. The first time, it took about a week to really kick in and stop the behavior, and then totally went away after 3 months, and I started the behavior again. I recently had my second session, and I'm finding again it's taking about a week to kick in. Is this gradual change common?
For some
people, why would it go away after 3 months?
For some people, it is like that. And I don't think anyone knows why it will disappear after some time. And that's why I really suggest you bring a recording device. When it starts to diminish, you simply play the recording and you have it again. And that typically happens with something called trichotillomania. Trichotillomania is compulsive hair pulling for which there is no guaranteed medical treatment. But hypnosis works very well. In fact, I hypnotized someone years and years ago for trick, and she called me, maybe 10 years afterward, and said, I have a problem. You've hypnotized me. I will never pull out my hair again. I don't need a wig. I have no more bald spots. I'm turning gray. I want to pull out a hair, and I can't do it.
A listener asks, Amir, does self-hypnosis work?
Well, you know, it's funny that you know, people are always focused on this issue with self-hypnosis versus hypnosis through a particular operator or a therapist. Any kind of hypnosis at the end of the day is self-hypnosis. Any kind of hypnosis is always self-hypnosis because it's the individual who does the work. In very extreme, rare cases, when you're dealing with a hypnotic virtuoso who's like going into spontaneous trance just by, you know, a particular cue or something like that, that's really not the common theme. Most people, when they follow an induction or when they go into a hypnotic state, they actually do it themselves. The person who's helping them, be it the therapist or again the operator, whatever word you want to call it, this person is just helping and just making sure that, you know, everything is done safely and correctly and gradually and with the right pace. And at the end of the day, any kind of hypnosis or largely any kind of hypnosis is self-hypnosis. So it does work.
Let's take a call from Louisa in Paramus. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I really just wanted to touch on the fact that hypnosis is such a wide-ranging term. I used something. I was at Columbia Presbyterian about to have open heart surgery 10 years ago. I was terrified. I had a toddler. I didn't know the outcome. I was really very nervous. And Dr. Mehmet Oz did my surgery, and he had just helped establish an alternative medicine department. And there was a gentleman there whose name, unfortunately, I cannot recall. I wish I could give him credit. And we did something called guided imagery.
I think I know who it was.
Oh, do you?
His first name was Jersey. Is that right?
For the life of me, I cannot remember. Yeah. And all I can say is that it was such a positive experience because it's such a terrifying thing to confront when you've been healthy all your life and all of a sudden you have to go and get such a traumatic event on your person, on your physical being. And it was really a wonderful way to approach it, to have him help me project myself after the surgery. What would I want to do after? What did I plan to do? Could I see myself doing something else? And the gentleman just mentioned before that all hypnosis is self-hypnosis, and it was actually him telling me to take myself to another place after I was in this suggestive, relaxed state. And it's not like in the movies where you don't know what's going on. I remember I could hear traffic outside. It was in Manhattan. I could hear, you know, fire trucks and ambulances and people walking in the hallway. But I was still someplace else, which was fascinating to me. And I really
think you're describing it very nicely. I think you're actually able to capture it exactly correctly. Hypnosis is not what most people think it is. Most people think, you know, that they would say, oh, I all this happened to me, but I don't think I was really hypnotized, because they're really waiting for something super dramatic. Well, they would feel like they've never felt before. But you're exactly right. Most people would have exactly your experience. It's a very strong dissociation. You're able to retain and remain the kind of person that you are. And you are able to dissociate very strongly from your common, you know, reality and everyday experience by following a particular suggestion and complying with it to your benefit.
But Amir, many people would also associate hypnosis with being with a magician making them quack like a chicken, even though they don't want to do that. And that, I think, is where some people are afraid. But we've gotten so many calls from people who want to know about pain in childbirth, stage fright, pain. Where else do we have these things? In all of these things, it would work. Why aren't we seeing more people being hypnotized before they have to experience painful things?
Well, if it were a pill that a pharmaceutical company would advertise, you would definitely see it. But who's to benefit from the hypnosis? Neither Amir nor I is going to put on an advertising campaign to let the world know.
Well, if people, for example, if somebody wanted to quit smoking, you'd put on an advertising campaign or get them to stick to a diet. Does that work?
Sure, it works.
Or to have them overcome stage fright?
Certainly. I routinely do that. It works very well, and it's very easy. And as far as pain goes, the only means of anesthesia that carries no danger of a side effect is hypnosis.
But what about, as one listener asks, the placebo effect? Do we know whether hypnosis really works?
Yeah, there's no question that there's a placebo component, in any hypnotic interaction. But then, you know, people must remember that there's a placebo component, larger or smaller, in just about any interaction, any therapeutic interaction, be it a drug interaction, or a behavioral interaction. So it's quite clear, and part of my research, part of my research actually shows this, you know, unequivocally. It's quite clear that placebo effects exist in hypnosis and in hypnotic treatments, but then again, they exist everywhere in medicine, and sometimes, as we have learned recently, for example, they're even very prominent even when it comes to some of the backbone drugs in psychiatry today. So, for example, antidepressants and depression. So it's quite clear that there is a placebo component. However, the research shows that there is more to it than just a placebo effect that would dismiss the whole thing.
A listener is concerned about false memories, which we read about a lot 10 years ago or so, that had been induced by hypnotism. So suggestible people can remember things that they didn't really experience?
Well, they'll remember it if it's implanted by the unscrupulous hypnotist.
Mm-hmm. So that's a negative side.
Yeah, there are some dangers. The dangers are really not in hypnosis, not in the process. The dangers are in the hypnotist.
And you want to add to that, Doctor?
Yes. The reason that I always insist that my clients and I write out their suggestions ahead of time. We talk and decide ahead of time what I will say to them when they are hypnotized. And I think everyone should insist upon that.
And if I may, it's important to emphasize, for balance and also for purposes of scientific accuracy, hypnosis is one tool out of many. It's a powerful behavioral tool. It works very effectively with some people and, you know, less effectively with others. And it's something that, you know, because it's relatively easy to access and because it's, you know, relatively easy to practice, is probably undervalued. value it at the moment for all kinds of reasons. Some of them have to do with politics of science and trendy things and history and a checkered history and so on. But it's important to understand that we're not talking about like a panacea here. It's not like the apotheosis of medicine and, you know, everybody, you know, forgot about it and now we're beginning to remember that it was there all along. It's something that is definitely, you know, a powerful behavioral technique. People use it and have used it and, you know, probably will continue to use it in the future. It has been very successful with some individuals, and sometimes the results are, you know, very, very dramatic, and it's good that that's the case. And it's also important to, you know, appreciate that the American Medical Association officially approved clinical use of hypnosis in 1958, and then the American Psychological Association approved in 1960. So it's clear also that, the medical establishment, the psychological establishment is aware of these things, and I think that just like with anything else, they're slowly opening up to it, particularly as there's more and more scientific evidence and clinical evidence to suggest that it's viable.
Mitch in Austin, Texas wonders, has hypnosis ever been used to extract information during interrogation of terrorists or criminals? I think he's been watching that show on television where they have to use torture instead.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you that this is definitely something that happened in the past. People have used hypnosis just like they've used many other techniques, sometimes experimentally and sometimes, you know, less so.
Did anybody tell Dick Cheney about that?
Sorry?
Has anybody told Dick Cheney about that?
Well, I don't know about Dick Cheney, but I think that in general, it's quite clear today that the kind of information that you can extract with hypnosis, and that's part of the reason also that it's, you know, it's not a viable or a valid tool in a court of law, is sometimes bogus, and you need to corroborate the information with a lot of, you know, external sources. So it is true that people under hypnosis would sometimes be able to recall certain, you know, things that would be more difficult for them to recall. Without hypnosis or without, you know, focused relaxation. And it's also true that some people might behave differently or be able to resist differently when they're under hypnosis. But these are not necessarily the most reliable effects, and there's huge individual variability.
We have very little time left, but I'm just going to run through some of the other things that people are concerned about. Ruth from Portland, Oregon wonders about phobias like fear of spiders. Somebody else wonders about insomnia, somebody with a picky eater kid. All of these work with...
Picky eater kids are a piece of cake. I love it. I love working with them. I simply tell them, I ask them what their favorite food is. I find another food that they don't want to eat. I tell them from now on, food number two is going to taste just like food number one, and it's done.
I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us, talking about hypnosis on today's Please Explain. Dr. Roberta Temes is a hypnotist, a psychologist, and author of The Complete Idiot's Guide to Hypnosis, available at your local bookstore. Dr. Amir Raz is in the Department of Psychology, Neurology, and Neurosurgery, and I can't go through any of the rest. Thank you so much.